if he thought that he was any better than anybody else in the family inheritance or anything like that. He never would join the Scotch Society or anything like that. And when my mother would go to a meeting of the Daughters of the American Revolution, he used to call it your IWW, which in those days was a term of reproach.
Well, that's fascinating. Would you like to comment any more about the people of the area, or do you want to turn to your mother's side of the family? Or I do want to get back to this birth in 1902, of course, as well as their marriage the year before.
Yes. Well, I might say that my mother was born in Vermont. The Jamisons came over in, I believe it was 1630. I think they came in the ship Arabella.
That was her mother's side of the family?
That was her mother's father's ancestors.
J-E-N-N-I-S-O-N.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And they came to the Boston area. And in the Book of Genealogy, you can trace from the first ones there right on how they kept moving a little west and a little north until her father was most of his life, maybe all of his life, in the extreme north of Vermont, within a few miles of the Canadian border. And they had gradually moved up to there. And one of her ancestors was a minister who was in the same church for 70 years and only missed 77 Sundays for any reason whatever from his pulpit in the course of the 70 years. He was great-great-great-grandfather, something like that.
Didn't they give him any vacations, or did he attend there even when he had Sunday off?
I don't know, but this was what it said in the Book of Genealogy. When I was in high school, I used to go down to the big Los Angeles library to prepare for debates, and when I'd get tired of the debating material, I would go over to the genealogical section. And, of course, I couldn't find anything about my father there, but my mother being from New England and people being very hepped on genealogy there, you could trace many of her ancestors, you know, through different lines. I made a chart showing a lot of them at that time. And there's a book that has about eight families, and one of which is the Jamison genealogy, and it gives each generation with all the children and who they married and so on. And I trace, I found a connection that connected up with someone from whom, a man whom by his first wife, John Adams, was descended from him, and by the second wife, my mother was descended from him. And, of course, once you got onto that line, of course, somebody had traced it back to England. And once you get back to England, you get into a ducal family. It was easy to get back to William the Conqueror and Charlemagne and so on. So I thought that I found a lot of fun in doing that, but there's no importance to it. I just figured one time, back to Charlemagne, how many generations would there be? And then figuring two parents, four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, and so on, why you get a figure for the number of, if there was no duplication, the number of ancestors you'd have had that many generations back would be three or four times as many people as all the people in Europe at that time. So I think you can safely say that everybody living today who had ancestors in Europe at the time of Charlemagne had Charlemagne for one of their ancestors. But it was sort of interesting to be able to trace it. When I was in college, I mentioned that to a girl who was in one of my classes, and she said, I wonder if they have anything there about Litchfield, Vermont. She said, my ancestors came from there, and she said, I have heard that one of my ancestors was Ethan Allen, the conqueror of Ticonderoga, you know, in the Revolutionary War. Mm. And I said, well, let's go down to the library and see if we can find anything. And we got there, and sure enough, they had a family history of Litchfield. And we looked into it, and there was Ethan Allen. But it began Ethan Allen, not the redoubtable hero of Ticonderoga, but the man what run the grist mill down the other end of town. So she gave up interest in tracing her ancestors. That's it.
So,
but my mother was brought up there in northern Vermont, and she then moved to Connecticut, and in Hartford she had relatives there she lived with, and she had a near nervous breakdown.
Now, this was did her parents move to Hartford with her?
No,
I see. How old would she have been about? Why did she move?
She'd have been in her 20s.
So she was on her own, essentially.
She was on her own.
And moved down to Hartford with other relatives.
Yes.
On the claim?
Influenced by their mother than by their father. And so I think our system of naming us after the fathers, you often think, how can people with the same name be so different? And actually, I think one reason is you trace, for instance, the English kings. You look at Edward I, II, and III, and what different personalities they've had. So very different. But I think the mother has the greater influence. So actually, if our names went through our mothers, it would tell much more about us than our present system going through our fathers. So I tried to trace mine. So my mother was Eunice Jennison, and her mother was Lucia Catlin, and her mother was Anna Barstow, and her mother was Esther Owens, and I got the place where she lived, but I know nothing about her. So that's as far as I can trace on the female line. So, and I think she was the one that once I traced from Oliver Cromwell down to a woman of the same name who lived in the same town. So I thought there was an interesting line going back to Oliver Cromwell, but then I found the dates didn't jive, so it probably was a different person of the same name.
So your maternal grandmother's maiden name was, again, what?
She was Lucia Catlin. Catlin.
I see.
There was a Catlin who was quite a famous American painter for American Indians, but whether he was related to us, I just don't know.
And the Jennisons were Vermonters from a way back.
Well, no, they came originally to Massachusetts, and then they gradually moved west and north. And I don't know, I've got the genealogy right in the next room, but I don't know how long they were in Vermont.
But the
Catlins, they gradually moved north to there.
The Catlins had been in New England too for some time?
Oh yes, but I don't recall how long.
So your mother was a Yankee par excellence.
Oh, her all of her ancestors would have been from England in the 17th century. As far as I know, there was nobody in her ancestry that had come to this country later than 1650.
Hmm. And so she went to relatives on the Jennison or the Catlin side in Hartford?
On the, I'm not sure now.
But she went down there. Yeah. You don't know why she left Vermont and went down there.
Well, maybe she wanted a place where she could have a... It was very rural where she was in Vermont. Maybe she wanted to be a secretary or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And she had something of a breakdown or a difficulty?
She had something of a near nervous breakdown. And had to just rest for a long period. And it's interesting that she had this in her 20s. And then after that, she had practically no illness in her whole life. She had most remarkable health right to the time of her death. Practically no illnesses. But she, somebody said once that if you want to live a long life, the best way to do it is to have a nervous breakdown in your early life and learn how to take care of yourself thereafter. But she was in this situation, and her sister and she made a trip to see one of their two brothers who had ran a store in Helena, Montana. And they made the trip out there to see their brother Charlie. And my father went out to further western Montana to see his brother Charlie. Hmm. And the result was that he saw her in the train. And, my mother says he mustn't tell anybody that. He wouldn't want anybody to know that he had met her in the train. But when you get on the train and have 3 or 4 days traveling, the same people are in the same car, you certainly get to know pretty well. And I don't know how much he got to know her there, but he was almost immediately impressed with what a wonderful mother she was. And they got acquainted, and then he began writing letters to her. And as I understand it, at first she wasn't really interested in him at all, but he kept writing her these letters. And she, in that condition of having to rest so much, found the letters a wonderful interlude when they came and got to where she was looking for those letters. And eventually he persuaded her to marry him. So he went up there to Vermont and married her and brought her back with him to Michigan there. And there she met many people whom he had known for years. And she never heard anybody make any allusion to his having ever looked at any other woman before. Hmm. And he was 39 when they were married. Yeah. So now, of course, that doesn't prove, but it's interesting that he just waited for her.
Was she, how much younger was she?
She was 31.
So they weren't terribly far apart.
No, they were closer than my wife and I are. We are now 11 years. I'm 11 years older than she is. Until next November, and then she'll catch up a year on. So I'll only be 10 then.
Well, we certainly want to get to that chapter in these interviews eventually. So she had not been to Michigan until she came there as a newlywed.
Yes.
I see.
She never had been before that. And then when I was coming, her sister Mary Edmund Jemison, was a nurse. And she came to help.
From Vermont Connecticut.
Somewhere there. She was active as a nurse. And she came and she lived with us and helped take care of me. And then she would act as nurse for my father, dispensing medicine and so on. And she lived with us permanently from then on.
That was your aunt?
We called her Nanny. We always called her Nanny, which I suppose was our childish way of saying aunt. I don't know, but we always called her Nanny. Her aunt, her name was Mary Edna Jensen. And
so you had an Aunt Mary on your father's side and an Aunt Mary on your mother's side.
Yes, and the Jones girls used to ridicule us for calling our aunt Mary on the mother's side Nanny, because they called their aunt Mary on my father's side Mamie, which they said was a much closer evocation of the name than the way we did. But so, we practically had two mothers, you see, because the two women were taking care of us, and they were with us until I entered college when my Aunt Mary died.
Hmm.
Well, it was very nice. She was a very fine woman.
Hmm.
Very pleasant.
That would have made a very nice household, having that.
It was very nice, yes.
That dimension there, yes, in,
yes,
that.
Yes, it was very nice. And when my father took us to Europe, she went along with us, yeah, too.
So she pretty much, she moved, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, yeah, but she moved to California with you then?
Yep.
And everything.
She was
essentially older. Was a part of the immediate family.
Part of the immediate family.
Did your mother have any other siblings?
There were the two brothers. Theodore, who ran a store in Vermont, and Charles, who ran a store in Helena, Montana.
Hmm. And then Mary and Eunice.
Yes, and her father had been married before. And his wife had suddenly died, but he had had, he'd had two sons by the first wife, two sons and maybe one or two daughters. And one of those sons had a lot of children. But you see, they were, well, we used to see some of the relatives occasionally on that side. They were separated from the family before he married Lucia Cattle, and from her he had the four children.
Did you ever go and visit these two uncles who were store owners in Vermont and Montana?
My first, when we visited Uncle Theodore, when I was quite a young, I was under 10, and we visited him, I saw a nice big hill over beyond, and I wanted to get to the top of it. And that was my first expression of my love of mountain climbing. And I went up, what did they call that first one? I can't think now, but there was another near called Leech's Ledge. And I just wanted to get up those two. And that was my first expression of that great love for mountains. My next was when we were going to Europe when I was 9, and I saw Mount Royal in Montreal, and I did want to go up that then, but I didn't get a chance to until 50 years later.
So, did you want to comment at all on their marriage or their settling down? You say that Aunt Mary came from the East before you were, at the time of your birth and because of your birth, essentially? Or?
That would be my guess. Mm-hmm. I have that impression, but I don't recall events quite that early. In fact, when I was 2 years old, we made a trip across Lake Superior in a boat to visit my father's aunt who was in Duluth. And I don't remember anything about it, whatever. But we had that trip when I was 2. The earliest recollection I have of anything is when I was 4. And yes, I used to think all I remembered about that was the time when I saw the Houghton Douglas Falls and slipped on a rock and fell in the water and got, it was just a shallow stream, but I remembered that. But now, come to think of it, I must remember when I was 4 because I entered school when I was 4. They took me in our area, at the Centennial School was only a little over the block from us, but they didn't have any kindergarten. And they thought I was not very sociable, and so they thought it would be good to be in kindergarten. So they went to Albion, which was half a mile the other direction, three quarters of a mile, I guess. And they took me there and put me into the school there where they had a kindergarten, and I stayed in kindergarten a year and a half. And I have rather vivid memories of that, how much I enjoyed it.
Hmm.
And then after a year and a half there, then they put me into grade 1B, and after a middle of semester, they moved me from that to 1A. So I took the whole first grade in one semester. And then the next fall, I got into second grade, and the teachers tried to have me stay after school and get ahead so they could push me further. And I objected to it. In second grade, I objected strongly, and so they gave that up that year. But the following year, when I went into third, they put me in the 2 semesters of third grade in one semester and the 2 semesters of fourth the next semester. So I had just half of the time of each of these. And, of course, I always got top grades in the what you might call the standard school courses. And then I would get the bottom grades in writing, drawing, and music. And those three, I always had the bottom grades. But I had the top grades in these others. And in music, I had a most unfortunate experience. I remember when I was very low grade, I came home and I sang "Oh Little February." You do not know how far I've come to meet you across the fields of snow. And they all complimented me on it because it's so rare to hear me sing. I guess because the family didn't sing around the house much. And then one of those times when I was pushed from the class, and often it would come, there'd be an epidemic, and the family would take me out of school, and then they'd teach me at home, and then they'd put me back, they'd put me in the next grade, you see. So that was all within 1 year, though, when I had third and fourth. But when I got in the fifth grade, you see, I was with class 2 years older than I was. And I continued that way until after, until before I went to seminary.
So when you graduated from high school then, you were what?
I got 16.
16 instead of 18.
Yeah. And all those years, I have always, until I got to thinking about it last week, I've always regretted, because I felt that I was always at a disadvantage socially because I was 2 years younger than all the others.
You had just turned 16, of course.
Yeah.
Too.
I just turned 16. No, I 16 February, and it was September or October when I entered college.
Right, but still in all, but when you would have graduated only a few months after turning 16.
Yes, from high school. And
the same with college.
Same with college.
Graduated a few months after turning 20.
20, yes. And I have, until last week, I've time and again said, wasn't that foolish? How much better it be that I'd have had the social contact with people my own age all those years. That would have been much better for my development. But now, as I think of it, I was just last week, I thought that was wrong, because what it meant was that after I graduated from college, I took a graduate year in college, and then I had a year at the Bible Institute. And if I hadn't been pushed that way, I would instead have gone over and over that elementary stuff that I learned quickly, and the value of those 2 years was very, very great. So I feel I was better off to have those 2 extra years that I got from it, even if I did have the disadvantage of being
so much younger all through school.
But that was a disadvantage from the social view. But on the other hand, I did so enjoy those 2 years, and I would have lost those and just been back and doing what I could just as well get in less time. But I was starting to mention there how during one of these times when I was out, they introduced the scales. And I got back to school as a little toddler. And, no, I was a little older than a toddler, but pretty small. And we went through geography and arithmetic, and I could memorize as well as the next, if not better than most of them. But then they put a big thing up on the front that had a, must be, 4 feet high and 7 feet wide, a big paper things that they would turn over. And they had lines drawn with them and a little thing down and the marks on them, the lines up and down. And and they would sing, do, me, do, re, la, sol. I had no idea in the world what they were doing, and I tried to make my mouth go the way the rest did. And nobody bothered to explain. Oh, they just said he's not musical, and they give me a low grade in music, and nobody bothered to explain anything to me. And of course, when I would try to sing and try to follow the others and be like them, what they sang, when they sang song, but when they sang do, mi, sol, la, I knew nothing about what they were driving at until I was in eighth grade. And when I was in eighth grade, we had a supervisor of music who saw my predicament, and she had me come to her office and gave me an hour to explain scales and teach me a little bit about it, and then she was transferred to another school. So I had maybe 5 or 6 hours, and if I only could have had that 5 years earlier, I would know double what I do about music today. And all that time, I was getting absolutely nothing out of it. And that I've always held that against those schools. Because it was a disadvantage. I love classical music, and I love operatic music. But I know practically nothing about it. It's just purely a matter of a feeling that I like it. But to understand it a bit more, which I certainly would have if I had had that advantage. So I've always held that against them, though I must say, the schools up there in Calumet were top grade. They really did teach well. And although I confess that in the grades there were times when I would notice the teachers saying things that were definitely wrong, didn't agree with the textbook. I would catch on the mistakes they made, but I think I had sense enough not to say anything about it. But they were good schools. And when I when I was in high school, first or second year, my father came home from the American Medical Association meeting, and he had bought a type. And he said, I bought this for you. And I was happy as could be. And so I went into the school I was taking, what they call the Latin course. They had four different courses. Six of them. Three college preparatory and three that weren't. And I took the Latin course, but I signed up for the four classes I was to take in high school, and then I signed for typewriting. And the principal called me into his office, and he said, you don't take typewriting, that's not part of the Latin course. He said, that is part of the commercial course, and you shouldn't take that. Well, I said, I want to learn to type. And, well, he says, but it's not part of your course. He says, we can't really give you credit for that. Well, I said, I'm not after credit. I'd like to learn to type. Well, he said, all right, we'd like to take it if you want. So I quickly learned the touch system. But, and I learned to type fairly rapidly, but not extremely accurately. But ever since, I've been so glad to be able to type. It was such a great thing. But if only that principal instead had encouraged me to go on with it and to take some shorthand, it would have been useful to me all my life. They had an excellent, excellent courses for commercial courses, but the people in the Latin course, they were a distinct breed from the people in the commercial. It was so foolish. Mm. I so regretted that.
Now, you mentioned that you didn't do well in music and writing, and there was a third
drawing.
Drawing.
I was no good, and I was. I inherited considerable of my father's intellectual abilities, but my father's real skill with his hands, I inherited none of. When I was in seventh grade, they would send us over to have a class in carpentry. For one semester we went over, and they had a piece of wood. You were supposed to chisel down a certain angle across, and you had to make about eight different things on that board. And before I would get more than half of it done, it would ruin the wood, and I'd have to start over. And they had about 30 of those things to go through, and in the whole, in 9/10 of the semester, I kept trying to make that one, which had these figures that every time it would break up. And after I finished that, finally, shortly before the end of the semester, then I did the next three or four without much difficulty, which were much more simple. As far as the handling is concerned, as far as the understanding, this was the preliminary thing for me. When I was in college, I took a course in botany, and the professor had us look through a microscope and see a leaf, you know, had us draw the leaves and draw the things. I told him, I said, I can't draw. He said, I can't draw. He came by one day, and he picks up my paper. He says, here's the man that said he couldn't draw, and he told the absolute truth. Well, and I would look in the microscope, and I would see the thing that the professor had in mind, and I would bring out the point he had in mind. And there was a girl there who would look in the microscope and make a beautiful picture of it, but the point of it didn't come out in it. And he thought her work was wonderful, but I did not inherit my father's excellent facility in doing things with his hands. I always was awkward with it, very awkward.
Now, did your difficulty with what they call writing relate to that same problem? It was a penmanship sort of thing.
Entirely, because from when I was in fourth grade, if I wondered whether a word was correctly spelled, all I'd have to do would be to write it. And I immediately, it didn't look right if it wasn't correctly spelled. And that's a strange thing, that I had that gift right from then. I've all my life, if I look at a page, it's been that there's one word misspelled on the page, I have to see it instantly.
as a block. An amazing facility.
Yes, strange.
Seeing you do
because
that.
I can't remember faces. I don't remember faces. I don't remember the appearance of cars or houses, things like that. My visible memory for that sort of thing is extremely poor and always has been. But I've always been able, either in something written in printed in capitals or small, or written in my scrawl. I immediately, when I see it, I say, no, that's misspelled. And of course, there isn't a great deal of logic to any spelling, so it's a queer sort of a gift. And it's so inconsistent with these other features of my visual memory.
Well, I certainly didn't mean to focus on those three areas, but I'm anxious now to turn to, what I'm really anxious to get to is all of the other areas, which, as you indicated, you did very well in through the years. Which of those were you, even though you did well in them, were more attractive to you, more interesting?
I always enjoyed anything of an intellectual nature. When I was very small, I liked stories tremendously. I loved fairy stories. I read all the fairy story books I could get my hand on. The red fairy story book, the yellow and the green, you remember that whole series. I think, was it Lang who put them out? I forget. But they were very nice. And then I got greatly interested, while quite young, in the books that gave the stories of the Iliad and the Odyssey. And I got a great interest in Greece from that. That's maybe when I was 7. And in those years, I was tremendously interested in ancient Greece. And then, when I was 9, my father's health had broken completely, and we went for the winter to Rome. And there, of course, I read about Rome and went and saw the places, and my interest moved from Greece to Rome then with that. But I always had that natural interest in most anything, particularly historical. There's so many of these things are just natural with people. They have certain abilities and certain lacks, and they can be developed to a certain extent. But a thing like this thing with me with spelling, you couldn't develop that. It's a natural, just a natural gift. And on the other hand, the ability, so many people can just look at a person, draw a little picture of it. I never had that ability to get the proportions right or the lines right or anything.
Well, I want to get to the family's moves and so on, but I would like to ask what other reading that you did and other things, impressions and experiences from those early years would you like to comment, either in school or outside of school?
When I was 10 years old, I started to read the Bible through. And I read a chapter every morning and a chapter every evening. I think I still have the Bible in which I wrote the date when I started it in 1912. And I read through Genesis and Exodus, and I got 5 chapters of Leviticus, and I quit. I just dropped it. It was several months before I took it up again. But then I went on, and then the time came when I found myself awfully bored in church. I don't remember just why or how it was, but I found myself terribly bored in church. And then they permitted me to go downstairs in the Sunday school room, which was empty, during the church. And I then read through down there the rest of Leviticus and on. When I believe I read all the rest of the Old Testament. I enjoyed it tremendously. And after I finished that, then I started again sitting through the church services. And we had a minister came from New England who had formerly issued a paper they called the Greylock, something, that was the name of a hill or mountain there. And this man had very interesting scientific comparisons and things, and I enjoyed his sermons tremendously for a few months, and then he got cancer. And that was just before I It was 1915 then, when I was 13, and I went to Montana for the summer. But it was before I went there, right? So I got there.
What church was the family attending?
We were then attending the Congregational Church there in Michigan had been settled from Boston, and the Copperland Congress had, and there was a lot of Congregational churches, and there were a lot of Methodist churches, a few Presbyterian churches.
So the family, as far as you, did your uncle Alan McIntyre's family go to the Congregational Church?
Boy, they did. Yes.
So your father found it rather logical to attend that church, probably even before he was married?
I guess so. They probably were the first Calvinistic churches in the area, and then the few Presbyterian churches came in later.
Now, what church was it? Was it the Congregational Church of Centennial, or was it over to Calumet?
There was a Methodist church in Centennial, which we used to go to once in a while. But there was a Congregational Church right in the center of Calumet. And there was one in Red Jacket also. I don't think there was one in Loring. There was one in Lake Linden, just a block from where my cousins lived. And they kept attending there. They attended that church until about 5 years ago, when there were only about 15 or 20 old folks who were still attending it. And eventually it was closed then. And now it is a museum for the Copper Country Museum.
Hmm.
And they have pictures of the early days.
But which church were you going to then at 13?
In Calumet.
The center one down at... The main one in...
I guess you would call it the main one.
Did it have a name, First Congregational? Or?
I'm not sure. We had, when I was a little boy, we had, they used to have in those days very lovely pictures of Bible scenes. And there was these picture of these Bible scenes, and then under it in big letters, the verse. I used to, as a boy, recite, "Out of Egypt have I called my son." Which would be the heading on one of these, these different pictures we would have in our house. And they would use them a great deal in the Sunday school. They had these, a lot of them together, like our set of maps, these pictures and the inscriptions under them.
But until your family left Centennial, they attended that church.
They attended that Congregational Church.
In Calumet.
And when we went to California, we lived in Pasadena first and went to the Congregational Church in Pasadena, where it was pretty much modernistic. And we were only there about 2 or 3 months, and we moved a few miles away to the edge of Los Angeles, where a second cousin of my mother's lived. And they all attended the Presbyterian Church there, the Highland Park Presbyterian Church, and we attended that then for the 10 years I was in California.
Now, you mentioned that your father's health broke at about age 53, was it?
Yeah.
An interview with Dr. Alan Alexander McRae for the Archives of Biblical Theological Seminary by Jim Pakula in Dr. McRae's living room at the seminary campus, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, on Friday, August 10th at about 4 p.m. Well, Dr. McRae, we've made two tapes, and at this point we're going to discuss, I believe, your travels before the family moved to California, to Florida, to Montana, to Europe, and some other experiences of this type and events preceding the move to California.
I believe the first trip I remember making I may have been only about 6 years old. I think it was in 1908 that my father came to attend a meeting of the American Medical Association in Philadelphia. I remember being left at night in the Bellevue Stratford Hotel while my father and mother went to one of the meetings in connection with the medical meetings. At that time also, we went up to Vermont and visited my uncle, and it may have been then that I first saw those hills in northern Vermont and began to take an interest in mountains. I'm not sure whether it was then or on my next visit to Vermont that I was determined to get to the top of every hill that I could and began my interest in mountain climbing. I believe the next trip that I had after that was when my father made a quick trip to Montana to see the property that was owned by McCrae Brothers, a firm composed of my father and his brother up there. And that was a quick trip. We were only gone maybe 10 days. And after all, in those days, it took three or four days on the train each way. I remember crossing the Badlands in Dakota and seeing them from the Northern Pacific train there. In those days, how I used to love, beginning then and in later years too, when I would ride on one of those Western trains to get on the little platform at the back end of the train. And there you could watch the track as you were riding backwards over it, and you could see the scenery so much better than from inside from the window. We used to get terribly covered with soot and dirt there, but it was very well worth it. And I never could understand why they didn't have observation cars like that in the east here. I finally found that they did have one on a train that left New York at night for Chicago. And I mentioned to Paul Woolley how stupid I thought it was to have it on a night train instead of a day train. And he said, oh, but it looks so beautiful leaving New York there seeing the lights. So that's why they run that thing all the way to Chicago. I thought that was ridiculous. In fact, as the years went by, I became more and more disgusted with the management of our American railroads. It seemed to me they looked ahead, or they really planned as they could have. When I was in Germany, there you would get a timetable, and it would have a map on it, and beside each stretch of railroad lines, there would be a number, giving the number of the place where you would find the schedule in the timetable. Whereas in this country, in most cases, you would have to, if you wanted, for instance, to go, say, by bus from two places that there wasn't a direct line across, you would have to look up in the index each name, each end, and it would give you maybe the 20 different numbers where they had buses from that. And in order to get a connection, it would take you half an hour to do what you could do in 2 minutes if you had the kind of map that they had in all of them in Europe. It's really a shame the way train service has degenerated in America. I think the officials of the train companies had a very, very foolish attitude. I know for a long time they would have nothing to do with electric lines. They were steam trains, and they looked on the electricity as an enemy. And eventually, of course, they did electrify all their lines. But if only, instead of fighting the buses and the trucks, they had been willing to develop a system of piggyback with trucks. Hundreds of men who today have to rush from one coast to the other. Terrible loss of human effort and energy. Could have simply put them on a train going from one coast to the other, and it would be so much easier and so much less expensive. It's the cheapest way to move is on solid rails. But they just wouldn't compromise with any other sort of thing, it seemed like. And today, the whole train system is suffering as a result. I think that they have been very backward in many ways. Of course, now the motor company, the automobile companies are having the same situation in relation to Japan. They've been so slow about adopting better methods. Now, we shouldn't waste time on my ideas things like this. But I was mentioning this quick trip we made to Montana, and we came back with a big trunk full of apples from the apple ranch they had out there, which we could munch on the rest of the winter. And
well, your father and his brother owned this ranch?
Yeah.
And the brother pretty much ran it?
The brother ran it. I think my father furnished the greater part of the finance for it. And he would go out every once in a while to see how things were going. But it was his brother who ran it, his brother Charles.
Mm-hmm.
And while we were there, we also visited my mother's brother, Charles. Father's brother was in the Bitterroot Valley in the extreme western end of Montana, while my mother's brother was had a grocery store in Helena, the capital.
Hmm.
So we visited both of them there at that time and on later occasions. Well, then you were speaking about trips. Now, I think the next would be that trip to Florida, which I mentioned before, I believe, in spring of 1911, when we took the train down to Jacksonville, Daytona Beach, and St. Augustine. Spring of 1911, when we took the train down to Jacksonville, Daytona Beach, and St. Augustine, and then we spent a couple of months in Miami. And there they put my sister and me in a wooden imitation of an airplane. And I had my hands on the controls, and she sat beside me. I guess I was 9, she was 7. And then they gave us postcards in which it looked as if we were way up in the air, and below us you could see the city of Miami. Somebody I showed it to said, did they have that airplane fastened in some way? And the other picture similarly took was of me having the reins of an ox cart. And in that case, the ox were tied to a post in the picture. But in this plain one, you would actually almost think it was up in the air.
This was like at an amusement park or at a studio or
something like that. I remember, that reminds me. While we were in Miami, we went to a palmist who looked at my hand and told my fortune. And said that could see that when I was in college, there was to be an incident involving a bottle and a gun, but nothing like that ever happened later. But also said I would live to be 92. And so far, the first part of the prediction has been proven false, but the second hasn't yet been proven false. Well,
Did you go to Florida for your father's health or just for a vacation?
Yes, his health was beginning to break. And they got along for a few years before he finally had to give up. When we had those tremendously cold winters with the great blizzards, he would just have to drop it and go off into the somewhere where it was warmer for a couple of months. And then he would leave us at home there, and he would get some doctor to take his practice while we were gone. And we had a big addition he had added to the house for a library, and he had a great many medical books in there. And I would go in and glance at these and wonder what they were about. And it just is a good illustration of how times have changed, that one time when my aunt was there, and the doctor who was taking his young doctor who was taking care of my father's patients was eating his meals with us, that I came out of the place there and I said to this doctor, I said, "What is gynecology?" And the man's face got so red and he could hardly speak and he was so embarrassed. He never did give me any idea in the world what it was about. I can't imagine anybody in these days being quite that modest.
Now, why was it that way during that era? It wasn't that way in 1811, was it? Why that change and so on?
In 1811, I don't remember that far back.
No, but I'm sure that, you know...
You don't think so?
Talk of those things was not, from what I've read, of the rather earthy life in Europe in the 16th or 17th or 18th centuries.
Well,
no one would be red-faced to use the word gynecology. Do those things go in cycles? Or I can't imagine myself having someone... red-faced over a medical term like gynecology.
Well, you can't today, no, but at that time, if he had simply said, why, that is diseases, that's a discussion of diseases that are confined to women, something like that, I'd have been perfectly satisfied.
Sure.
I wouldn't have known anything from it, but it would have been a satisfactory explanation and solved the question. But immediately he got so embarrassed that it really was sad.
Were there women present?
My aunt was present.
Yes. Hmm.
Yes.
That is interesting.
Yes.
Huh. Yeah, I remember you saying once in church history how people, you know, I think you were discussing the Victorian period.
Yes. Yes.
But how there's this pendulum, and you know, people get so uptight in one direction, and then it swings the other, and then maybe in reaction back the other way, and this kind of thing.
Well, of course, I think that the thing that causes it to go in one direction is you have a great revival, you have a great turning to the Lord and a turning away from sin, and you get your standards raised, and then there is a tendency perhaps to become, perhaps to go to an extreme in certain ways. And then those extremes of attitude are apt to continue after the real Christian feeling has begun to evaporate, I feel.
Mm.
But
there was something about these lemons on the train going to Florida.
Oh, didn't I discuss mentioned. That? In the,
I'm not sure. Was that when you first got to like lemons? I think that's what you said.
Yes, that was on our way to Florida that time. I remember the train was going through one of the southern states, and I went in the diner to eat, and I just immediately felt so carsick I couldn't eat a bite. Felt as if I was going to be really sick. And the dining car steward said to me, he said, "Why don't you suck a lemon? That will fix you up." And I had, previous to that, had always looked on lemons as something sour that I didn't like. I liked oranges. I didn't like lemons. But he gave me a lemon and made a little hole in one end of it, and I sucked it. And I got entirely over that. It felt fine. And after that, I had a great liking for lemons for many years.
Now, you probably had only the change in Chicago. Did you have a through train to Florida?
From Chicago, the Dixie Flyer, they called it.
Oh, yes. Did you have berths, upper and lower berths?
We had upper and lower berths in those days. And speaking of that, I always used to travel in upper berths. And I liked the upper berth. It was further away from the wheels. It was less jarring. You didn't hear as much of people walking through the aisles. There was less disturbance. I just loved upper berths. And in the Pullman cars, the making of the car, so as to have the upper berth, was the most expensive feature of making the car. And yet, the lower berth would sell for maybe a third more than the upper. And the railroads simply were determined that they would get that extra little bit of money to have people ride lower berths. So I remember after I was teaching at the time, I forget whether Chicago, St. Louis, one of those cities, I got a ticket, and I said I'd like to have an upper berth at such a place. And he said, well, I think maybe I could get you a lower. I said, I don't want a lower. I want an upper. And so I got the upper. I got to the place where you left the main waiting room of the station, and I showed my ticket, and the ticket man said, I think I could get you a lower. No, I said, I want the upper. I got on the train, and the train conductor saw me. He said, say, I think I could get you a lower. Well, I said, I want an upper. And trains would go with the lowers full and the uppers empty. And people that wanted to go and couldn't get one would ride underneath. And I used to feel embarrassed because they made you feel as if you were a cheapskate riding in an upper. And I decided not to do that anymore. So when anybody would say to me, I can get you an upper, I would say, no, I want to sleep well. And immediately the train man would say, I always take the uppers myself. It's much better. But they must have been ordered by the company to try to sell the lower. Another example of penny-wise and palm foolish, you might say. Mm. Well, I loved those uppers, and I was quite sorry when they took them away and made all the roomettes and compartments and all that sort of thing. And I think perhaps that helped to the decline of train service. They didn't have, it was more expensive and less pleasant. But you were speaking about my father, that he would, after he had to pick up and leave sometimes in the winter, then he began to plan them.
I see.
And we took this trip to Florida. We were gone maybe 6 weeks, I don't know. And then they planned the next year to go to Europe.
I see.
So the next year we left at the end of September, and we didn't get back until, I guess it was beginning of May, I forget just when the Titanic sunk. We got back to our home a week or 10 days after the Titanic sunk.
Now, the Titanic sank in 1912.
Yes.
So
1912. We went over in end of September 1911.
We went
over.
Mm-hmm.
And we got, I think it was the Laurentic on the White Star Line. It took us from Montreal, and we went up the St. Lawrence, or down the St. Lawrence, about 3 days, very smooth, calm riding. And then we passed Belle Isle and got into the ocean, and immediately the side of the boat would lift way up in the air and then drop way down again. It was fun trying to go upstairs. You hardly could get up to the next step when it was going up, and then going down, you could just go up the steps in no time, and vice versa.
Huh.
Yes, it was. Huh. I enjoyed that trip over. Then we got to London, and I always loved magic very much. And in London, they had the small magicians on the streets, and they had the one with the monkey that would play the machine.
Oh, yeah.
So what do you call it? The hurdy-gurdy man, was it? And I went to magical performance in London, and how I loved it. And we went up to see Henry VIII's palace. The name slips me at the instant. But this palace Henry VIII had built there. We had a very interesting time in London, beautiful weather. Then we went over to Paris for a few days, and it rained all the time in Paris. And I remember a man in London. Oh, they were all going on the left side of the road. And I said, well, why don't you go on the right side? Drive on the right side like we do in America. Well, he said, the wheel of the car is on the right side. And we have to go on the left in order to see how close we are to the other car when we meet one. And he said, we couldn't possibly shift to the right side unless they moved the wheel away from the right side to the left side of the car. And I don't know when that change was made in the United States. Of course, in those days, there wasn't enough traffic that you had to bother much about. My father was one of the few people in our area that had an automobile, and we often would have to stop when we would meet somebody with a horse and buggy, and he'd go out, and the horse would begin to jump around, get scared of his life of the car, and father would have to go and take a hold of the bridle and lead the horse past the automobile.
Huh.
So But after, in London, they had the traffic superbly handled. I remember one thing in London, if we'd ask anybody where something was, they'd say, oh, just down to the bottom, about 5 minutes walk. And we'd walk for 20 minutes and ask them where it was, and they'd point the same direction again and say, oh, just down at the bottom, about a 5 minute walk. But then in Paris, they seemed to have no control of traffic at all. It was really an interesting contrast to London. And, of course, I didn't get a good picture of Paris because it rained the whole 4 days that we were there. Then we went to Basel and then to Luzerne, beautiful mountain scenes there. And then on to Italy, to Milan, Venice, Florence, and Rome, and spent the winter there in Rome.
Now, why did he decide upon Rome? Did some travel agent in Michigan recommend that, or?
I don't know. I just don't know how he decided, how he came to. But I'm glad we stayed quite a while so we could really get to know the place.
Now, you rented an apartment there?
We went to a hotel, an English hotel, on the street of the Via Due Macelli, the street of the two butchers. And we were there about a week or 10 days. And then they decided that in this low altitude, in this part of Rome, there was apt to be malaria. So we left that hotel and we went up to an upper part of the city, right near the gate of the 20th September, of the 20th September, which I think is the day when the Italians broke into Rome and seized it in 1870. And this was a German hotel. And we spent the rest of several months there in this hotel. Very nice place, nice service, nice meals. Enjoyed it very much. But then I used to have, I had a little hoop. I was only 9 years old, and I had this, I think I became nine while I was in Rome. And I had this little hoop and a stick, and I would push the hoop and go all over Rome. We never thought of danger in those days like they do here in America. It was wonderful. I guess parents sometimes are worried, but not enough to put any strings on us. And I used to go to the Forum. There was a man named Clark who conducted tours through the Forum lectures, and I went with him on Saturdays on a number of occasions. And I wept when his wife, who had been ill, died, and the result was he would leave Rome and I'd get no more of these lectures. Later I saw him when he was principal of Venice High School in California. Huh. Years later he tried to get me to come and teach ancient history, but I decided not to.
But you didn't. So you, this was happenstance that he was the same person. That it,
I suppose so. Yes, I suppose it was. I enjoyed his lectures so much, and I didn't care much for painting at that time. I was bored by Florence. Now I love Florence, but then I was bored by it. But I loved the statues. And in the Vatican, the Gallery of Statuary used to have free admission on Saturdays. And just about every Saturday I would go there and see the Laocoon, these statues, the Nile, representing the Nile, and all these other statues, which I loved so much. And my sister, being 2.5 years younger than I was, I don't think she got hardly anything out of the trip. But to me, it left a tremendous impression, lasting impression. Then we... and then speak of foolish things, another foolish thing. They got a woman to give me some tutoring in French when we were in Rome. And of all the foolish things, if they had gotten somebody to give me some tutoring in Italian, and when I could talk Italian then with the people there, I'd have something worthwhile. Whereas to try to learn a little French at the age of 9 in a place where Italian was being spoken was just an utter waste. But the main thing I got out of it was the ability to count rapidly in French, and since you can go so much faster in French than in English, when, after we came back, when I play hide and seek and you're supposed to count up to a certain number, I'd always count in French. But then after these wonderful months in Rome, then we took the train to Naples, and at Naples we got a German boat, the König Albert, and we had a lovely trip across the Mediterranean, or the length of the Mediterranean from there west. I remember the day when you could see Spain on one side and the coast of Africa on the other side nearly all day. And everything was so calm, so lovely. And then the next morning we were in the ocean and it was jumping around. Oh, and I meant to mention, when we first left London for France, we got onto the cross channel boat, and the boat started and the wind was blowing. Oh, I just thrilled to it, and I went out and ran back and forth on the deck and enjoyed it for about 7 or 8 minutes, and then I felt miserable. I came inside and my father lay on like a bench, and right above it there was another upper place, and I got in that, and for the next several hours neither of us knew whether he was going to live or die. Hopefully he wouldn't live. It was a miserable thing. Then we landed at Rouen, or landed at Dieppe, and took the train to Rouen, which I was much interested to see because it was there that Richard the Lionheart, his heart was buried. Huh. And I wanted to see that. But when we got to Rouen, we got off the train. We were all still kind of shaky from the cross channel trip, and they had reservations at the Hotel Louis Le Grand, and we went downstairs and we were all very tired from the train, you know, and we had all our baggage for the whole winter, and a man came up to us with a push cart, and my father says, "Hotel Louis Le Grand." "Oh, yes, Hotel, oui, Hotel Louis Le Grand." He piled all this luggage on that push cart and went out down the street fast he could go, and we had to rush to try to keep up with him, and walked about 6 or 7 blocks down the street, came to the hotel, and they told us there was a bus that went right straight across it all the way. That was our introduction to France.
Huh. And you could have taken this bus and avoided all that.
Avoided all of that. Huh. Yes. One of the little experiences that stick in one's memory.
Of course. Of course.
Yes.
You did not go to school then in Rome.
No.
Now, you were you already... A year ahead, or was that the year that made you?
No, I got ahead in school because the year I took third and fourth grade, they moved me forward 3 times in the year. So I took the 2 grades complete, both halves of the 2 grades in 1 year, and that was the one time. Of course, I started kindergarten when I was 4. I had a year and a half of kindergarten.
Now, did this then set you back?
No.
You just...
I had a month of school. I had a month of school before we went. When I got back, I went to what they called the grading room. And a woman tutored me in arithmetic. And they said that was the only thing that I would need to get. As a matter of fact, it seems as if most of the other subjects they'd had in sixth grade, they went back and started all over again. So I didn't lose any.
So the fall of 1912, you started seventh grade.
Yes, started seventh grade. And there I had a very interesting experience. I went to the YMCA during the summer and did quite a little swimming. And didn't take care of my ears as I should have, I guess, because the night before school was to start, I had a terrible earache. And in fact, they punctured the eardrum. And the result was I was 2 weeks late starting third grade. And I got into a class different from any I've ever had in my life, or at least in those 8 grades of grade school. The teacher there, Miss Foley.
This was 3rd grade.
This was 7th grade.
7th grade.
The teacher there would each month give a test in each of the 4 main subjects. She would take these 4 tests, and she would, one was given each week. These 4 tests would be averaged together. It seems to me there were maybe 60 or more in the class. And the boys were seated on one side, the girls on the other. And the central 2 rows, the front of each of them would be to the one with the highest average, and then the next and the next and the next and so on. Back the middle 2 rows for the ones with top grades, and then the boys one side and the girls the other as they went down to the lowest grade. And the result of my being 2 weeks late was I only had 2 tests. So instead of adding the grades in 4 tests and dividing by 4, she added the grades in 2 tests and divided by 4.
Oh.
And this may be the 3rd lowest in the class. And so I had a most interesting month as I sat back there in the 3rd from the bottom of the class for 1 month. Next month, I was the first one in the center, and I stayed there the rest of the semester. And the boy who sat in the back of me, who had been the first month, and the girl who was first in the other, they continued the rest of the semester. The next semester, we were with a different teacher who didn't have this system, and both of them dropped back to mediocre.
Huh.
There were 2 people who, the fact of having the stimulus.
So that stimulus of the particular system that one teacher used motivated them to do well, but then they dropped back.
Yes, I remember during that semester, one day writing the date on my tablet, 12-12-12, and realizing that was the last time in that century that you would have exactly that combination.
That's interesting
that
you write that, because when it was 7777, I remember my mother remarking about that.
Yes.
We wouldn't have this again until 8888.
Yes.
And to have someone say that they remember writing 12-12-12.
Yes, that was interesting.
Indeed.
Yes.
Little things like that that you don't...
Yes. Now, we didn't mention the coming back after we went
through.
Oh, might mention also that when I got on the boat, we got on the ship, there was a man there who was coming over here to, he was a representative of the Pope. I forget, he was an archbishop, I think. And his name was Bonzano. And I used to sit up on his knee and read to him out of his Latin Bible some. And his secretary, another man, who was a layman who was there, had a ticket for the Titanic, had intended to go on the Titanic, but then finding that Bonzano was coming on this, he came with him. And years later, I read about his coming as papal nuncio to the United States to preside at a Eucharistic Congress, and Governor Al Smith of New York kneeling and kissing his ring and all that. And it was interesting to remember that contact.
And you had sat on his knee. And
yes.
Isn't that something?
Yes.
Huh.
But just about the time we went through Gibraltar, past Gibraltar, and got onto the ocean, we heard by cable about the Titanic having sunk, hit an iceberg and sunk, and hundreds of people being drowned. And many people on the boat walked in the ship. They would walk the decks all night long first, so to be ready in case of any calamity. But we went to bed and slept soundly, because we figured the time to be scared is just before an accident, not just after. Just after they were
extra careful after getting that word.
Absolutely. I think they went 50 miles further south than they had intended to avoid any danger icebergs.
What was it like when you, was there much, did you get, you didn't have any access to newspapers or anything like that. Did you get more details on the ship, or was it mentioned when you got to?
Yes, when we got to New York, we got newspapers that had full accounts of it. The papers were a few days old, but they had the complete accounts of it, of it, which I was tremendously interested in, as you can imagine at that time.
Yeah. I remember you saying once in a remarkable address or remarks that you were making publicly, that if the Titanic had hit the iceberg straight on, or if they hadn't seen it as soon as they did and it had veered more, or had, well, that would have been if they'd hit it straight on, but if they had seen it sooner and they had veered more, then they wouldn't have sliced through all these watertight compartments, but it was just they hit it.
There's a book called The Night to, A Night to Remember. And the man who wrote that book has written one since called A Day of Infamy about Pearl Harbor. And he got all the detail he could about each of these incidents. And in that one, he says that when the Titanic left London, somebody said to one of the ships and said, I understand this ship is so built that there's absolutely no danger. And this man connected to the ship said, oh, it said God Almighty couldn't sink this ship. And it was supposed to have these compartments so that even if one compartment or two or maybe even three were destroyed, the rest would still float. But according to his account there, when it saw the man in the crow's nest, saw the iceberg, if he had seen it just a little bit sooner, they could have turned in time to avoid hitting it. And if he'd seen it a little later, they'd have run right into it. And if they ran right into it, they might have destroyed one or two of these compartments and might have killed a couple of hundred people. But instead of 1,000 being drowned, it would have been, and it would have been disabled, but
still floating.
But according to his account, the captain didn't think it amounted to a great deal, and he got the builder who was on the boat, and they went down to the first compartment and found that the ice had made just a thin line cut through the iron, and the water was coming in. They went to the second bulkhead, and it was coming in. And the third, I think it was also coming in the fourth. And when they found that, the captain said, well, what do you think? Is this going to be serious? Can we easily get rid of this water? And he said, I give it an hour and a half before it sinks. Something like that, if I recall correctly, is in this book. And it does make a tremendous illustration, because evidently, the Lord timed it just exactly so. But then they could have, on the one hand, escaped if he'd seen it slight bit sooner. On the other hand, they could have still floated and maybe a couple of hundred people being killed instead of 1,000. Well, it was very striking.
But did people talk to you after you got back to Calumet? Was there any talk of that disaster and of your crossing at the same time, or did it pretty much die down by then?
I don't recall. I couldn't say
it. Skipping ahead, just chronologically for a moment, I saw on Channel 12, the educational station, they had this series on disasters and things, and they mentioned the Mont Blanc, which blew up in the harbor in the British Isles during near the beginning of World War I. Do you recall anything about that? It was a ship coming from New York or somewhere over here that had a lot of ammunition and arms and bombs and things on it.
World War I?
Yes, and it exploded because it ran into a Belgian ship. or maybe it was Belgium, but I think the nationalities of the two ships were different. And it was the largest explosion until World War II,
really?
With the huge bombs and things.
Strange, I would never have heard of that.
It mentioned, in fact, on the program how the Titanic is remembered, but the Mont Blanc, which civilians miles away along the hillsides of the harbor were killed and so on from the explosion.
Strange, I don't remember ever hearing that.
It's interesting. And they also mentioned a ship in Chicago that turned over on a holiday.
Yeah, yeah, the people all rushed to one side.
Do you remember that?
I remember reading about that.
Yeah. I guess that was in the 20s.
Was it? Yes.
Huh.
Yes.
How these things are.
Yes. Well, now, you were interested in trips. After that, I had 7th grade there and 8th grade, and then went into high school. We had very good schools there in Thailand. Oh, I remember. I think it was in 7th grade. I'm not quite sure. It might have been 8th grade. Anyway, one day, the teacher in the class said, "What is style?" And asked one, and one of the pupils said, "Well, style is the way we dress." And then asked another one, "What would you say style is?" "Well, style is the way we do things." And then asked me, and I said, "Style is the manner in which we express ourselves." And she said, "Look at page so-and-so in the grammar." And we turned to it. Style is the manner in which we express ourselves. I had never seen that, and I was so embarrassed. Said it.
And yet, on the other hand, it's kind of a compliment to use the more generic sense in your definition, which was what she was after there.
I gave her what she was after, but then it would be in exactly the words the book used, which I had never seen before. It would look as if I was reading ahead or something.
Now, did you go to Montana alone in high school?
After my first year of high school, that would be 1914. Yes, in the summer of 1914 would be just before I... yes, 1914 was when the World War I broke out. And I remember then at Copper Harbor, northern... when I was reading how the Allied powers had all just torn up the cables so that Germany couldn't communicate with the United States. And I was pressed then that ready to disbelieve what the Western powers would say if they would prevent the Germans from being heard at all. And that was the beginning of the war. And I always had a tendency to be a bit skeptical. Even as a boy, I remember everybody, when I was a boy, "Oh, we've licked England twice and we can do it again if we have to." And the exact opposite of the present situation as far as patriotism is concerned. And it was seemed to me jingoistic. And I was always feeling it was going carried too far in those days. Of course, now it's gone far too far the opposite direction now. But the war broke out then, and in the fall of 14. And then in 15, I went to Montana by myself. I was 13. And they put me on the sleeper in Calumet, and that took me to Duluth. And then I got the train south from Duluth to Minneapolis, and I spent several days there with some relatives of my mother's. They took me to a service in the Episcopal Church, and they were quite dismayed that instead of being impressed by the beauty of the service, I was impressed by what I disagreed with in the sermon. Yeah. He talked about how we say to the Protestants, we say no unity. To the Romans, we say no liberty. I remember that so vividly. Still, these people, I think, were Episcopalians.
They thought that they were dismayed. They said, why do they talk about doctrine? They said, after all, members all know the doctrine already. And the visitors don't care anything about it. So why should we talk about doctrine? They said. But then they put me on the train in the Northern Pacific. And I went from there west several days and got to Missoula. And then in Missoula, I changed to the branch line that went 50 miles south down the Bitterroot Valley.
Oh, yeah.
And came to the little town of Woodside, which was about a mile and a half from the metropolis. Corvallis, which had 75 people in the population, Woodside was much smaller. And my uncle had his ranch at Woodside. And I spent the summer there. I had my own horse and used to go riding a lot there. And there were a lot of nice children there, and we used to play games. I had a very nice summer. And you know, there in Corvallis, I was told that a year, or am I getting ahead? I think I'm getting ahead to my next visit. Yeah, I'm getting ahead to my next visit to Montana. But anyway, one time or the other, I was told that a year or so before there had been 8 or 10 churches in Corvallis, and that someone had gone and tried to get these churches to unite in the Union Church, and they had gotten the Presbyterians and the Congregationalists and the Northern Methodists, the Baptists, I guess they all united into a community church, except the Southern Methodists, who refused to come into the Union. And so now there was the community church and the Southern Methodist Church way up there in Montana, which had twice the people that were in the community church.
Huh.
Oh, this was on a later visit. I recall now for sure. And I remember the minister giving a sermon on infant baptism. And he said, people say you should wait until a child is grown so he can make his own choice. Well, he said, suppose a child is grown and you say to him now, what is your choice? And he says, my choice would be to be baptized in infancy. He said, the only way a child can have his choice is to baptize him in infancy. He said, you say that wouldn't happen? He says, it happened with me. He said, my parents didn't believe in infant baptism, and I wasn't baptized. Then he said, they decided they did believe in it, and all my brothers and sisters were baptized, and I wasn't. And when I was grown, I was baptized, and I said, Mother, I wish I'd been baptized in infancy.
Was that at the Union Church or the Southern Methodist?
That was the Southern Methodist. In the Union Church, they had a man from McCormick Seminary who gave a young fellow, very nice young fellow, who gave a sermon on what would you wish you had done today 10,000 years from now. I thought it was quite impressive.
Huh. So you did attend both?
This was the later trip.
I see.
This was the later trip. But this is after I graduated from college, kind of thing. But we sometimes go to one, sometimes go to the other.
It's interesting that you mentioned that rail line south from Missoula. I've seen that line and traveled up, not on the line, but on the parallel highway.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in 1959, we came up from the south
through
that valley, which is one of my father's favorite parts of the country.
Oh, I love
and
that.
I remember looking in the Northern Pacific timetable, which back in 1959 included all the branch lines, even though there might not be passenger service, maybe just mixed trains or whatever.
I think Darby was the southern end of the fire.
And was there Hamilton?
Hamilton?
Yeah.
Hamilton was the bigger place, about 5 miles, I think, from Corvallis.
I see.
The
I remember Hamilton.
That part. Yes.
is looking at those rails in fact as we drove along.
Yeah,
and then we took the train that night. This would have been sometime in the summer of 59.
Yes.
From Missoula, from the station.
Oh, you did.
But that branch line, it's interesting how when you mention it immediately clicked.
Yeah.
And that's been 25 years.
Yes, that is. Yes. Well, I had a wonderful summer there in Montana that summer. Then, when I got back, I took the train back, of course, and there I was, let's see, that was 1915, I was 13, and one night we were to arrive in Minneapolis the next morning, so I went into the station, one place the train stopped, to give send a telegram to tell them when I would arrive. And I gave the telegram saying it will arrive such a time tomorrow morning. And he said it's 62 cents, I guess. So I gave him a silver dollar. And immediately he took the silver dollar and rang it on the there to make sure it rang right. So when he gave me the change, I picked up the change and I think I took a nickel or a penny, and I rang it before.
Well, was that? Did you use a silver dollar because they used so many out in Montana? Or?
Oh, we all used silver dollars.
Even in Michigan.
Oh yes, we didn't use paper money. But people wanted real money. They wanted hard money.
So you used gold coins then for higher denominations, or?
I don't recall there, but we used to use them in California sometimes. And we always used silver dollars in California when I was first there.
Not the paper dollar.
Not much. I remember one time giving a $10 bill and getting nine silver dollars in change, which made quite a little loaf.
My only experience with that was in Montana in the late 50s, I guess, early 60s, where in certain sections of rural Montana, You'd go along and indeed you'd stop at a diner or something and they would, the currency for the $1 denomination was the silver dollar.
Yes.
It was interesting. We were, of course, fascinated.
Yes. I remember how shocked I was when I first went to Princeton. Being up in New York at a drugstore, we got some ice cream for several of us, and I handed them $10 gold piece, and the girl didn't even know what it was. I was really shocked. Of course, now I doubt if they know anywhere in the country what it is. But then you were asked about that trip to Montana was the summer. It was very nice.
Of 14.
Of 15. Uh-huh. Summer 15. Oh, we went up to Missoula to the Stampede. The Stampede was an occasion on which they had the men, I guess they call it a rodeo now. They call it there the Stampede, and they had the men competing with bulldogging steers, you know, jumping from their horse and getting it by the horns and throwing it, and all those different things that they would do. I remember that sort of thing.
You just had finished ninth grade.
Yes.
Now, you hadn't moved yet